CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Scott Sackett will be telling us about a virtual reality autism event. So what can you tell me about the virtual autism event?
Well, we held an event for World Autism Month at St. Bonaventure University that included a virtual reality. This virtual reality was created by two artists, Martine Asselon and Annick Dignot. I believe they're from Montreal. Martine is an artist that works in cinema and digital media, and Annick, whom I did meet on Zoom and talked to her in advance, she has a background in theater and performance. And both of them have children, sons, with autism. I'm pretty sure they're both sons. And the children went to school together, and when they met, they wanted to create something that would allow people to understand autism better. And they probably, I'm just sort of inferring from what I've read and what I heard, they were probably thinking about documentary, but they really wanted to make this more about experiencing autism from the inside out. And somehow they stumbled on the idea of creating virtual reality. Well, one of my colleagues at the university, Professor Heather Harris, had experienced this in Montreal, and she wanted to bring it to our university. And so we planned this day-long event where we have the virtual reality goggles with the handsets. And this program that was installed, it's called LUVR, LUV Virtual Reality, or in French, les pieds en haut, feet in the air. It's about this boy named Lou and his experiences as a child with autism. There are two stories. One is when he's 5 years old and he's nonverbal, and the other is when he first enters high school and he's verbal at that point. And so this whole day was dedicated to allowing students and faculty and members of the community in Olean to come and try this program, this virtual reality experience. And it's really like what they call docufiction. These are two stories that immerse users in the sensory experiences of a child with autism. The day was fantastic. We also ended, well, I shouldn't say we ended. In the middle of the day, we had this panel discussion with university professors and then a friend of mine who's a disabilities reporter at WBFO, the NPR station in Buffalo, serving Buffalo, Toronto, public media. That's Emily Watkins. So the experiences that we heard from the students were so highly positive. My colleagues, Professor Harris and Professor DeSimone and I, we talked to students afterward. We elicited their responses. Many of them had family members, friends who with autism, and they had great experiences, very positive experiences. They seemed to relate. And others, such as myself, I have no experience with autism. I had no experience with autism. And Cam, I just want to share an anecdote. I know you asked how the day went, and it, again, very positive experiences across the board. We asked everyone to sort of relay how they were feeling, what they felt, and we wanted to be on hand just for emotional support. And you may hear my voice. As I was getting ready for this event, I was loading the software, and I was testing it out. And I think it was when Lou was just entering high school. And I was practicing with it. And there's the spoiler alert, you know, there's an incident where Lou is in high school, and he's trying to close his school locker. And I am Lou. Well, you become Lou as 5 years old, you become Lou as the teenager. And I couldn't close the locker door. And I can't go any further until I close it. And I started slamming it harder and harder. And I started getting really frustrated. And then, of course, all the kids were laughing. And they were trying to figure out what was going on. And it was just such an emotional experience to feel what was going on. Lou was just trying to close his door. And he was in an alternate reality. And everyone else was standing around him. They weren't laughing, but they were really wondering, why is this kid slamming these doors? And I, you know, you can hear my voice. I was just so moved. And so my colleagues and I, we wanted to be on hand just in case someone had a really powerful reaction, as I had had. I was all alone in the broadcast studio, and we wanted to make sure that people had some way to decompress. Because it can be very powerful. And I just want to mention again, I have no experience. I don't have anyone in my family. I do have students. And this was one of the reasons we decided to recognize World Autism a month. It's the right thing to do anyway. But I have students who self-identify. And then I have students that I highly suspect are somewhere on the autism spectrum disorder scale. And I want, as a teacher, I want to be a better teacher and to work with them and to help them and understand. And again, this was very, very powerful what these two Canadian artists had created called Lou VR.
So do you think that the fact that this was done in a cool, tech-based sort of way might have a hand in sort of making it more relatable, more open to an audience such as yourself who had less experience when it comes to autism? I mean, presenting it in a relatable way would seem to be sort of opening the door towards asking the right questions.
I think so, for two reasons. One, I think students wanted to come out and experience, you know, virtual reality, right? It's not, my students, you know, 19, 20, 21, they love technology. And I'm pretty sure some of them were just drawn to the fact that I can go, you know, try this VR experience. I think the creators, Martine, Anik, and Anik, they really hit on something in telling this story. Again, it is not a documentary. You do not watch. You do not hear interviews. You experience as Lou. Now, they're very clear about this. This is not having autism. And we stress this with students. They call it a metaphoric interpretation. And even understanding that as a teacher, it was very, very powerful. So I think they chose the right technology to attract people, and also to get an empathetic reaction from people of what it's like, the joys, the crises, all the various stimuli. You know, when Lou is overwhelmed with stimuli, they've created this sensory experience in the virtual reality world, which again it's a metaphoric interpretation, but. You know, it's very overwhelming. You know, you feel like, wow, all these stimuli are really overwhelming my senses. It's so loud. It's so confusing. I can't concentrate. So they were able to create something that allowed me to experience something that's an analog. And in that regard, I think it's very powerful.
So do you see yourself and St. Bonaventure doing events like this in the future? I mean, setting the precedent for disability awareness in such a well-received and such an honestly cool way of doing it. might open the door for building more bridges.
I believe so. So I'm now the incoming chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, and I am going to advocate for doing more of these events, and we may do LUVR again. There are so many areas, and I'll be honest, Cam, you and I have started to discuss this. We're going through a renovation now, and there are so many considerations to ensure that people with various abilities feel a sense of belonging, you know, don't feel frustrated, have places to go. You pointed out to me that that's something that's easily overlooked, just having a place for people to go when they're feeling overwhelmed. And that, I can see how easily that can get overlooked. You know, I consider myself someone who's sensitive. I'm an advocate, but I don't know these things. I'm willing to learn. So I think having these events on a regular basis is critical. It's critical because we have these students now and they'll graduate and we'll have new faculty. So I'd like to bring other events like LUVR or bring LUVR right back again because I think it's highly valuable.
Right. Thank you for taking time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. In this segment of our show, Bob McGuire will be telling us a little bit about the War Amps. So what can you tell me about your work with the War Amps?
Absolutely. My name is Bob McGuire. I am a public awareness specialist with the War Amps. I've been in this role for about 6 years now. My role is multifaceted. No 2 days are the same. A lot of it is just going out into the community and representing our association and speaking about the programs and services that the War Amps provides to Canadian amputees. I'm an amputee myself, I should mention. I was born missing 3 fingers on my right hand, and when I was 4 years old, I became a member of the War Amps. So I've been a part of the War Amps almost my entire life.
So when you go out and do community engagement for the War Amps, do you find that people are typically responsive and want to hear more about the work and what's available for amputees?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of people have heard about the War Amps through our PSAs, but, you know, going into the public and just sharing the scope of the work we do, I think everyone's pleasantly surprised on how much we are able to help amputees for the past 100 plus years now.
So what are some of the most commonly accessed programs and services?
For our amputees, we're able to provide a lot of support, both emotionally and financially. On the financial aspects, we're able to pay for prosthetic limbs, for arms and legs for all amputees, but all children and adult amputees within Canada. As you can imagine, they are very expensive, and, you know, we're able to provide that support so kids can be kids and they're able to do any activity that they want to. And we're also able to provide with our emotional support, connecting amputees with other amputees so they know they're not alone themselves.
So in that sense, I'd imagine meeting someone like themselves would have a huge mental health impact, because it's got to be an enormous sort of initial shock coming from an amputation.
Oh, exactly. I can speak to my own story. I grew up in a very small town of just 400 people in Ontario, and, you know, growing up, I thought I was the only amputee in the world. I didn't know there were other people that had hands like me, and it wasn't until I went to a seminar, and that's something that the War Amps puts on that brings all amputees together, and I was able to see an older amputee who had a hand like mine, and he was able to do everything from playing hockey to just, you know, really being confident. And seeing that confident older amputee changed my life for the better. And it's because of those War Amps that, you know, made those connections for me. It made me a better person on who I am today.
So, in your work, Has there been any success story that stands out for you, where you were able to provide especially meaningful direction and support for an amputee?
Countless come to mind. One in particular is from a young kid. Growing up, he and his brother were very competitive with one another, and it was when the Warramps was able to get him a prosthetic leg that for the first time he was able to outrun his brother, and it just made him so happy, you know. And we hear those stories all those times of, you know, champs are our child amputees, just overcoming any obstacle and really wearing their amputation as a badge of courage. And that is just the best, you know. I can't explain it, how happy it makes me feel when, you know, kids can be kids.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for more inclusion and more equality for amputees, what would you say?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions out there is that, you know, amputees can't do everything, but that's just not true. You know, amputees are very persistent. They will find a way to do something. It just might be a different way. It might be a way with using a device or a prosthetic, but, you know, if we can get rid of those pre-assumptions and see that, you know, amputees are no different than anyone else, I think the world would be a better place.
So, what are the next steps in your work?
Oh, that's a good question as well. I think the next steps in my work, we're going to continue to advocate for all amputees. Our child amputee program is going to be turning 50 next year, so we're going to continue what we've always been doing, providing support. And, you know, we've been advocating for amputees for the past 100 years. We started after the First World War, so we're really looking onto the next 100 years as well.
So where can people go about finding more information about the Warramps?
Absolutely. You can go to our website. It is waramps.ca. And then if you have any questions as well, our 1-800 number is 1-800-250-3030. And we'll be able to answer any questions you may have as well.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Blood donors are needed now as much as ever. If you would like to help meet the needs of patients across Canada, please consider booking an appointment by calling 1-800-2-DONATE. That is 1-800-236-6283, or by visiting blood.ca or through the Give Blood app. The Windsor Blood Donation Centre location is at 3909 Grand Maris Road East. Make a difference with the Canadian Blood Services.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Bob McGuire told us a bit about the Warramps, and we heard about an amazing virtual autism event from Scott Sackett of St. Bonaventure University. In this segment of our show, Lindsay Bourdon will be telling us a little bit about the 3Q29 Foundation. So what can you tell me about the Foundation's work?
3Q29 Foundation is for patients and families of patients with 3Q29 deletion and duplication syndromes, and we're working to raise money to help fund research for treatments in the future, and also for community building and to increase access to information and resources on this condition to help families navigate this diagnosis, which is not common and often hard to find information on.
So, what are some of the common impacts of the deletion or duplication syndromes?
So deletions in general share a lot of common impacts. Duplications are a little bit different. In this condition, there is about 20 genes that are either deleted or duplicated. And certainly in the deletion, there's a higher rate of autism. But there's often developmental delays, reflexes associated with it, sometimes seizures in the case of duplications, and weight gain in the case of duplications. And in deletion, some of the children have failure to thrive, but many are on the autism spectrum, and there is an association with schizophrenia.
So, that being said, I'm guessing there's a risk of misdiagnosis given the spate of symptoms.
Well, often people will get diagnosed because they have a story of missed milestones throughout early development. And if you have a child who's on the autism spectrum, they'll often now in developed countries do what's called a microarray panel, which will look for these short segments of either deleted or duplicated genetic information. In the past, when there were screenings early on in like the 80s, they would do what's called a nuchal test, where they checked in an ultrasound for the depth of the back of the neck as a sign being abnormal for trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. And then they started looking at larger, triplicates of the 21st chromosome, which is Down syndrome. That's easy to see. And they have made more advances. And now it's not just full chromosomal deletions or duplications. They're looking at micro deletions and duplications, which are much smaller, and they're not seen to the eye on normal testing. It's genetic testing.
So how does the foundation reach out to the families affected by these conditions to let them know there is support and there are people working to just improve the quality of life and the research?
So we have a really great board who does a lot of outreach, and we also have a wonderful researcher that we work with at Rutgers named Jennifer Mulay, and she has a registry that she first started at Emory University and has now brought to Rutgers, and families can join the registry so that they can get information and connect with other families. And we also have a Facebook page, and the foundation has a contact location so that families can contact us. But never before was there a foundation or a website for the foundation. And now that we have it, it's a place that families can go to and connect, and we can guide them toward other families in their area.
So I'm guessing that bringing these families together would sort of be a game-changing experience. In rare conditions, meeting someone like themselves for the first time create a lot of shared insight.
Absolutely. I actually think that's a huge part of managing the emotions that you go through when your child is diagnosed. If you have another family that's been through it and someone that you can reach out to with questions, or even help find any physician who is familiar with the condition, which is rare because it's not a common condition, it's very helpful. And I think that social support is critical when families are first getting this diagnosis.
So in your time with the foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
So far, I think the biggest successes have been just getting the foundation established. It is a big lift. I mean, we have the goals of starting a clinic for patients who have this so that there's one group that is familiar with seeing children and adults with this condition and can give answers not just as an N of one, but can have experience with many of these people. And we've been able to basically lay the groundwork for how in the future we hope this will happen. That will come along hopefully with some fundraising, but we all have the same goals. And I think just making this our hope for the future and laying out the framework for how we can get there is a pretty big achievement so far. We're a pretty new foundation, but we have a good roadmap.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by these conditions?
So 3Q29 affects about 1 in 30,000 people. It's on par with a more commonly known condition called Huntington's. And most of the people who have this across the world have not been diagnosed. It's a relatively new condition that has been identified, but more and more people are being identified across the globe as testing becomes more readily available.
So what are the next steps forward for the foundation?
I think to reach our goals, our biggest efforts need to be toward fundraising, just so that we can set up the clinic. And I think in addition to that, just continue to connect families who really need support from other families.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward, to get the clinic established and for research to continue, what would you say?
I would say, in an effort to get the research established, I would say if you can obviously help with any fundraising or messaging or just any sort of community education so that people have awareness, because I think in bringing awareness about this condition, there's more effort put into finding an answer for people who have this. And I also think that many of the people who have it don't have a diagnosis and have never been given an answer for why they have certain symptoms or why they might have an autism diagnosis. And I think just having an awareness that there's a potential reason for these things and that there's a test available to give them an answer is enough to get more people tested, which would then give some momentum to the need for more answers in terms of doing additional research and finding funding. But the small number of people who have it right now isn't... you know, I don't know if it's enough to really get the ball rolling, but I think that once we do get some momentum and more people get a diagnosis, it will be seen as a condition that needs some attention, not just from donors, but from the NIH. So I think the goal is that once you get some grant money and you can get a clinic, then you can also apply for NIH grants and you can do things that will forward the research both through private donations and through government support.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem.
Thanks. I really must congratulate Scott and St. Bonaventure on an incredibly novel idea. Truth of the matter is, you can't live someone's life for them. Therefore, understanding exactly what someone with a disability thinks and feels and experiences can be a challenge. But having the opportunity to see through their eyes, even for a moment in time, can be an eye-opening, life-changing experience. But the fact is, there are many times in our lives we assume our way of thinking is the only one. We have the only perspective, and others always share it. Being able to live those moments, experiencing some of the things that were described in this virtual story, is just an amazing thing. But the truth is, once you have that new perspective, that new vision, if you will, seeing life with a disability in a new way, you don't go back to the way things were. You come to realize the world isn't defined in terms of black and white. There are so many vibrant shades and so many diverse ability levels out there. And doing that in a cool and relatable way is always the best approach. You want something people can easily relate to and say, this is a unique experience. If you just look at a statistic and say, yeah, that's a tragedy, people will tend to have less of a reaction. Is it the same situation? Oh yes. But is it our own perspective that changes how we look at it? A person's story versus what seems to be an overwhelming situation. It's all in the eye of the beholder, my friends. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.